So today I'm going to talk a little bit about patterns of LD, or linkage disequilibrium, and just touch on haplotype diversity in elite historical malting barley lines. What's different about this data set compared to a lot of other LD pattern analysis that's out there right now is that we're looking at this historical group of lines that are from a single breeding program. Most studies to date have either used national or regional variety trials, so you're getting varieties coming from different breeding programs, or they're choosing representative accessions from germplasm banks. And so we really want to try and get a feel for whether or not association mapping, which is kind of the next phase of things, will be very feasible within a single breeding program. And the Minnesota Barley Program is a really good example of how narrow a single breeding program can be and how that narrowness may be to our advantage or a disadvantage. So just a quick overview of what I'm going to touch on. I'll explain what this germplasm data set really consists of, talk about the markers and the single nucleotide polymorphisms that we used, and then get into results, primarily patterns of LD. And just as a reminder, LD is the non-random association of alleles at two loci. And it's really important, particularly in this case, as we will see, that it is a function of the population that you assess LD in. And that's something that's extremely important when you're thinking about designing association mapping studies down the line. And then I'll touch on haplotype diversity and then draw some conclusions and really talk about what some of those implications for conducting association mapping may be. So the germplasm, this is a pedigree of the seven most recent releases from the Minnesota program, and they are the things that are actually named lower down in this pedigree. But it's quite a closed program. It started in the early 1900s as a part-time project amongst a few different breeders at the University of Minnesota. And in the late 1950s, a full-time breeder was hired, and he really practiced very much an elite-by-elite method of breeding. He's well known for saying if you cross junk with junk, you get junk. So he very much was into using elite lines. Based on pedigree analysis, the germplasm base of the program can be traced essentially back to seven parents, which account for about 71% of that germplasm base. So we are talking about few founders. I'll keep talking about these three groups, the parental lines, which are circled in the gold color and are at the top of this pedigree. The early elites, which were from the first two decades of when that sole breeder was hired, and then in the blue, the later elite lines, which were the following two decades. And so based on previous work with these lines using SSRs, regions or markers that had been identified as having evidence for selection were found, and those regions are those regions that I chose to look at with LD with this greater marker density that we have with the SNPs. And so those SNPs, there's about 1,500 SNPs on the platform that was used in this case. 1,100 of those approximately have been mapped in one of three doubled haploid mapping populations. Of those mapped markers, when you consider only the parental lines, only 65% have a minor allele frequency of at least 5%. And because many measures of LD are dependent upon allele frequency, you do need to set some threshold to include markers in your analysis. And I chose 5% because of this elite-by-elite nature of this germplasm. We start reducing the number of markers that we're using, and so I wanted to keep some robustness in the data set to that regard. If you consider all the elite lines, so both the early elites and later elites, that number of markers that meets the 5% minor allele frequency drops to only about 30% of those that were mapped. So you can see that identifying polymorphic markers alone, if you're using your contemporary germplasm in a breeding program like this, finding those polymorphic markers is going to be an important piece of the puzzle. So I know that this slide's really busy, so I'll walk you through one because we'll be going through a few that are like this. So this is three plots of linkage disequilibrium organized by groups. So we have the parental lines on the left, early elites in the center, and the later elites on the right. Organized in marker order across the chromosomes, so the top of the chromosome is at the top of the graph. If you lined up the chromosome pairwise, the comparisons would fall along the diagonal for immediately adjacent markers. The more red a square is, the more LD there is. And then the false discovery rate for the rate of LD is here as well. And then the R squared threshold is set by a 5% significance level. And so you can see here for chromosome 4H that regions that were identified as being under selection in the previous work, and these are the SSR loci indicated here, we do see substantial increases in LD with breeding, which is what we would expect, particularly as chromosome 4H has a lot of malting quality related QTLs, and that's one of the major traits that we do breed for, so we would expect that selection would be acting on this region. Just as a point of reference to understand the effect that fixation of alleles probably is having on some of this analysis, this is the later alleles of that same chromosome. On the left-hand side, I've colored those comparisons where a single marker is fixed in blue and where both markers under comparison are fixed in green. And you can see that much of the areas that were red are actually at least partially fixed, and so that's, again, the allele, the polymorphism in your population and under what you're considering will be important in what is useful for doing association mapping. On chromosome 7, we have 7H. There's two different regions that we were had of interest. At the top of the chromosome, RPG1 is a stem rust resistance gene that has been under extremely high selection pressure in the Minnesota program. But at the other end of the chromosome, we have BMAG120, which was not showing evidence for selection with the SSRs. And we can see that even though there wasn't evidence for selection around BMAG120, we do see a substantial increase in LD. So you can't presume that if you have evidence for selection in a region, that that means that you have LD, and that if you don't have evidence for selection, that you won't have higher LD in that region. That's really one of the take-home messages, to me at least, is that you need to understand the pattern of LD in the population you're working with because it may not necessarily act as you would expect. Chromosome 6H, there wasn't evidence for selection at two markers in the previous work, and you can see that the LD away from the diagonal disappears with breeding, but there is still some LD that is in between immediately adjacent markers, which will be useful during association mapping, but what does have implications for the necessary marker density when conducting association mapping studies. And on chromosome 5H, another region that wasn't under selection at the telomere, you can see there's some LD that's still there, but the patterns are not emerging as clearly. What I think is of interest on 5H is that we see this region of higher LD appear in the early alleles, but when we move to the later alleles, that disappears. And the explanations for why that's happening are still something that I'd like to investigate more. Though most of the parents were contributing early on in the founding of the breeding program, there were some parents that were brought into the program later, so that introduction of allelic diversity later may have something to do with that change in LD. And so just one slide on haplotype diversity. On the left, we have graphical genotypes of the parental lines. You can see that there's many different across the entire chromosome. We can see a lot of different kinds of haplotypes, whereas in our later alleles, you can actually count the number of haplotypes across an entire chromosome amongst even more lines. What's interesting to know here is that all of these lines that have the light blue for the entire chromosome, that is where all of our actually released varieties are, have that haplotype, and then our newest variety candidate has only this single region that's making it a unique haplotype. So we can clearly see that the haplotype diversity decreases with breeding, which is what we would expect, particularly in this quite closed breeding program. So some of the things to remember from this work really are that LD is highly variable across the genome. Each chromosome has different patterns, and we expect that breeding is influencing that. It may be due to the selection pressure we're putting on things, but also because of this narrow germplasm base and how we advance lines, drift cannot be ruled out at this point and is very likely also contributing to those patterns in LD, and again, haplotype diversity does decrease. So what are some of the implications for these results on designing association mapping studies? First and foremost, particularly in a program like Minnesota's where it is quite a narrow germplasm base, finding appropriate markers that actually show polymorphism really is the first step. And then I think you should really assess LD in the population that you'd like to conduct association mapping with so that you can determine if you need to increase marker density in certain regions where you don't have very extensive LD, where the LD decays rapidly, so that you have a better chance of actually being close enough to a gene to detect an association. And of course, phenotypic variation is always very important when conducting any kind of mapping study. Some of the advantages of association mapping really are that you're going to identify QTL that are useful and in relevant backgrounds. So when you're conducting these kinds of studies within your own breeding program, you know that what you detect is already available to you in the germplasm you have to work with, so it should be very easy to deploy and implement and select for, and also that you're seeing how those QTL behave in your relevant germplasm. So I guess my biggest take-home message for you today is to assess LD first so that you can design an association mapping experiment that will be fruitful. And with that, I'd like to acknowledge Xiaomen Chow at the USDA Small Grains Genotyping Center in Fargo, North Dakota, for doing all the genotyping analysis on this work. And the American Malting Barley Association, they helped fund the prior graduate student who did a lot of the previous work, and the CSRAES and the Barley CAP project for funding my research. Thank you.
Okay, since I have no closing remarks, we have a full 15 minutes for questions.
He's my advisor and he's cruel.
No, we have time for any questions for Carol.
Mm-hmm. What you want is more structure first instead of LD first?
And we have explored some of that structure in the previous work, but we wanted to look at, in most association mapping approaches, you account for structure as an independent piece of the model, but LD in and of itself is not a piece of the model that we use. Does that make sense? So you account for structure within your model, and so then it's the other inherent LD. And this, and that's part of the reason I broke the groups up separately, is that that will help. We used the pedigree to account for structure, not marker relatedness. Sorry? No, we used pedigree to explain structure rather than doing markers to explain structure. Yeah?
Could you expand on that? How valid do you think it is to use pedigree instead of markers?
There's pluses and minuses to both, because if when using pedigree, the previous work that Federico did, RPG1 that we know is a locus that provides stem rest resistance, the pedigree accounted for that variation, and so it didn't appear in the association analysis. So sometimes you can lose good things because of the accounting for structure, because it was associated with that structure. I know a lot of association mapping approaches now are even using both markers and pedigree together. I think it's a lot of it depends on the kind of data that you have available to you and the kind of data set you're working with. I think for this kind of data set, using pedigree, because we have all that information, makes it easy, and then you don't have to worry about the having independent markers to include in your model for accounting for structure. I think it'll be useful, and we've used it with the SSRs, the previous work. They did actually do some association mapping with it, and I'm working on validating those SSRs now. I think it will be useful within our breeding program to find QTLs that we can still exploit, because a lot of the major complexes, particularly for malting quality, which is what I'm interested in, have already essentially been fixed in our program. So finding those other more minor effect QTL that are still segregating in our program, I think a data set like this will be useful, because we've, to some degree, you could almost think about it maybe as being like near isogenic lines, where you've fixed a lot, you know, we've fixed chromosome 4H practically. And so what are the other smaller effect QTLs elsewhere in the genome that we still have variability for? Because we do see large phenotypic variation still within this data set. So we have the phenotypic variation and I think it will work. We'll see where that's kind of the next step. We'll see how successful it is.
Where the theory was back years ago, you know, let's only breed the best of the best. And we're, you know, looking at variety, looking at markers, trying to, you know, narrow in very small things, whether it's multi-quality, whether it's trust. You know, we're being very myopic on exactly what that plant has to do. Mm-hmm. At what point do you see a breeding program like that hitting a dead end where there's no genetic diversity left? Mm-hmm. And where that variety gets introduced maybe in a region further away from where it was originally developed, where it's going to fail because it doesn't have the ability to withstand maybe drought stress if she wasn't bred under in Minnesota, mm-hmm. or that type of thing. You know, at what point do you have to go way back into the program again, and then maybe start off another B team and bring along the line so that you have something to contribute to the A team once you run into these problems?
And that actually happened in the 90s because of Fusarium head blight. So now we sort of have, to some degree, parallel programs. We still, there is a portion of our program that is still this elite by elite, but then alongside that, we've opened the program back up, bringing in sources of resistance. And so another piece of this work that's the next part is to compare the structure of LD within that the closed elite by elite to those newer lines that we've opened it back up, and how has opening it back up changed structures of LD, and is there comparisons of how association mapping between or amongst both of those groups might work better? I'm not sure if that answers your question.
All right,
well, thank you.
Questions.